This is the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 2 of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast, the best named podcast in the business. My name is Matt Wolf, and I'll be your host. Our topic for this podcast is designing dexterity games. To discuss this topic, I have two designers who both recently have designed dexterity games. The first one up is James Myers. Hey, James.
How you doing?
And our second designer is Drew Hicks. Hey, Drew.
Hey, what's up?
Now, before we get to our main topic, first we're going to do our designer discovery segment, where we'll talk more with our guest designers and get their background. So we'll start off with James. James, why did you start designing tabletop games?
Well, I started designing games mainly because I had mechanics, mechanisms that I really liked, and I wanted to see what I could do with them. And of course, initially, it was a huge failure. It was the gigantic project that, you know, you walk into it and you have no idea what you're doing, but you go for it, and then you realize it's way beyond what you're capable of, and you scale it back and try again.
What was that?
That was a game called Turnpike, and I believe I made the mistake of making a huge prototype before I even saw if it worked or not. And it was something like 200 index cards and a giant board, and yeah, that one has long since been recycled.
Yeah, I remember a lot of little fiddly bits in that one.
And it didn't work at all.
And that's okay. Now you know. How about you, Drew? Why did you get into design tabletop games?
Started designing tabletop games because I was homeschooled and extremely bored. Just during the day, after completing a bunch of stuff, I was really interested in games in general, video games and tabletop games as well. Not very many of the other kids in the cohort that I was in were interested in that kind of thing. So instead of playing games with people, I basically ended up making my own games, and I spent a lot of time at the sort of prototyping stage, just making a bunch of stuff out of paper and tape, to the point where I was typically in trouble for stealing anything that was like that in the house. Like, just, where's the scotch tape, where's the scissors? Always in my room making tiles and cards and things. So,
what grades were you homeschooled for?
Most of 4th up through 8th, I think.
So you somewhere in there you started designing, like, do you remember what year?
Probably towards the younger end of that. I actually remember the first game that I designed was a game called Rush Hour, which was sort of a race game where you had to try to get a car to a bunch of places in a town and back to your house. It was a roll and move game, but you could basically cause accidents to block off roads so that people couldn't go those ways. And then in order to get past it, you had to do some other special thing. So that was probably in like 4th or 5th grade that I did that. So.
And James, when did you get started?
I actually didn't get started designing until after I started playing modern board games. Before that, I mainly approached this kind of thing from the creative side, from what they call world building, where I would just design a setting, and for long lines of for a story or for an RPG than for a board game.
So just kind of playing modern board games, that kind of sparked your interest in designing?
Yep, I was like, well, I like this game, and I like the mechanic in it, and what can I do with that mechanic that might be a little bit different?
So you said that you kind of did world building for RPGs. Was that for established systems, or did you try to roll your own systems?
It was a little bit of both. Try to combine some things for a few different systems, and then also try basically the game design version of NaNoWriMo, which was called Naga Demon, National Game Design Month.
You may have just summoned a demon. I'm not sure.
So I spent one November basically writing about 15,000 words of setting and a little bit of mechanics, and decided that RPG mechanics were not my forte, and decided to switch over to board games and see what I could do there.
How about you, Drew? Have you done any design outside of tabletop games?
Yeah, definitely. Actually, right now I'm working as a grad student at NC State, working on user-designed levels in educational video games. So I've designed a couple of different games for teaching math and programming. It's just simple, like, puzzle games, using like Unity and some other things like that. Also, I've done a little bit of RPG design previously, so made a bunch of stuff for D20 system on the old Wizards community forums a while back, and a couple different things like that. So actually, recently we did playtest a pen and paper RPG system I'm trying to work on, but it requires maybe a little bit too much burden of knowledge on the players, so I'm going to probably take that back to the drawing board.
So are you super interested in Mario Maker now?
Mario Maker is my absolute favorite thing right now. If you've been following my Twitter, basically been just shouting into the ether about it pretty much constantly, because I think it's pretty exceptional, but because there's a couple of things I think are pretty obvious, which we actually might end up talking about regarding the kind of data you get from playtesters, that it could have done to be better and to help teach people how to kind of iterate, but instead it doesn't do that and just lets bad stuff sit until it dies. So
we'll save that for a different episode, perhaps.
Yeah.
So, Drew, when you started designing tabletop stuff, what most surprised you about designing tabletop games?
Like I said, when I started, I was really young, and the games that I was designing at that time were pretty much falling into the typical kind of mass market Hasbro games. So they were either like party puzzle games where you would draw a card and either answer the question or riddle or whatever that's on it, and then move forward some spaces just arbitrarily, Mind Trap and that kind of thing. Or, like I said, roll and move style games, because it was the kind of mechanics that I knew about. So I guess the thing that surprised me the most was, I was doing that before I played any kind of, major hobby games. The first major hobby game I played was probably Axis and Allies, because a friend's dad had the Game Master series, and I saw them up on the shelf and was like, oh my gosh, those look really cool. Are those board games? And he's like, yeah. Like, can we play them? He's like, no, you can't play them. So I kept
he probably underestimated you.
I kept basically bugging him about it until he let me and his son and another of our friends play it, which I think we surprised him at how able to understand the massively complex game of Axis and Allies we were. And so I played that, and I was like, oh, there's a lot of different stuff that you can do. And so immediately started doing a bunch of incredibly overambitious stuff that looked like that. But I guess what surprised me was that there was that much more out there when I got started. So,
cool. How about you, James? What most surprised you?
I was definitely most surprised by how fast things can spiral out of control when you're designing. how quickly it is for a simple, let's play with set collection and see what we can do. How quickly that turns into 500 cards and three rounds and six player, how quickly it just explodes. And so that's actually been one of my things that I've been trying to work on lately as a designer, is how do I scale it back and create something that can actually be produced rather than just as a thought experiment or as a massive prototype.
That is a great idea for a future episode, so thank you. I think we'll notate that one. So the flip side of this question would be, James, what is exactly as you expected it to be?
Well, I always knew I was going to have difficulty writing rules, and that's pretty much as I expected it to be. Rules are a hard, pretty boring slog, but they are what's pretty darn important for the final product.
Now, that's really interesting, because you said that you kind of got started doing world building, and world building is essentially writing the rules of the world, right? Just in a more story format, I'm assuming.
Well, that's true. That's true. I mean, you have to establish, what exactly is going on in this situation, but you can write it in a much less linear format. So I can jump from a character to a nation, and then to the city, and then to this company, and back and forth. Whereas in rules, it's got to make sense for the player going, you do this step, and then this step, and then this step. Or it's like, if I could write, okay, this is how you do this part of the game, and this is how you do this part of the game, and this is how you do that part of the game, but not have to tell you, hey, you go from part A to part B to part C, then it would be a lot easier.
Gotcha. How about you, Drew? What was expected?
I guess the part that I expected to be the most difficult was, the last 10% of any given design. Getting the idea, building a bunch of parts, testing it a little bit, but those last refinements, getting it to where it's something that I could picture buying in a store was always what I thought was going to be the hardest, and I think that's still true. Just the last couple steps of any design.
And I bet you kind of have a lot of experience of that from the software development, that you've done as well, where that last 10% is always the hardest.
Yeah, definitely. Although I do have the luxury of being... So the research that I'm doing is on designing the system. So the last 10% becomes the next 10% after every time I complete it. Yeah, my whole goal with the research there is developing the next iteration. So
Drew, what piece of advice would you give to a new designer?
So I guess it's like the counterpart of that. So the last 10% is the hardest. So since that's going to be the hardest part, you should make sure to do the first 10% always, fast and as soon as you can. So anytime you have an idea, like, don't let it sit around and like be, oh, that's a really good idea, I'm just gonna keep it and just cherish it until I love it, and then maybe I'll work on it eventually. Like, get something that you can touch, get a prototype, and, you know, maybe it won't work, but once you have it, it's so much easier for you to make those changes and figure out if it does work, figure out what you need to change, figure out what needs to be cut out or what needs to be added. But until you've got something that you can actually play with, then I think that's, I don't know, you don't really have anything.
So when you get an idea for a game or a mechanism, you try to prototype immediately or as quickly as you can?
Absolutely. So I try to, like, it's always really, really rough. Like, one time I brought a prototype for just a system to one of the meetings. It was just, like, a bunch of colored blocks that I had. But I was like, I have an idea for a rule that might be pretty cool. You're trying to build these patterns, essentially, and on a shifting board. So I'm just going to, like, get some stuff that I might be able to use to make a shape like that and make that shape and try and play it and see what happens. And it's not even a game. It's just a mechanism at that point. But just having the ability to see it and play with it, just, I don't know, having something tangible makes it a lot easier for me to see the path forward. Whereas if you, you know, let an idea sit in your head for too long, you have, like, this beautiful Christmas land future of what the game would look like when it was completed, and then it's depressing to start and have something really basic not work. So you sit there and, like, fantasize about what the final product would be, and then you playtest something and you're like, oh, it just really, really does not work at all. It's harder to move forward from there because you feel like you've lost that idea.
And what's so great about bringing those or really early stage prototypes is that you're going to play with something like that. Like, I remember playing with the foam blocks.
Yeah.
And it was great. And so we said, well, what about if you do this? And we played with those, and we said, what about if you do this? And hopefully you walked away with more ideas than you came in with.
Definitely.
It's interesting. I don't disagree with what you're saying, but it is contrary to kind of what we were talking about on the last episode with the way that Burke and Mark and myself tend to do prototypes. And I think that kind of speaks that, you know, there's not necessarily one standard method, or there's not, there's not like one, this is the way you should do it. It's more, you know, you got to find what works for you. And there is a lot of that advice of, you know, kind of failing faster and, you know, get it to paper as soon as possible. And if that's what works for you as a designer, that's great. But I do think it is important that may not work for everyone.
Oh, sure.
People, especially new designers, they need to kind of play with the process a little bit to figure out what is going to work best for them. James, how about you? What piece of advice would you give to a new designer? And you can't take Drew's answer.
Well, I had the two that really affected me. And the first one is, don't be afraid to kill your dreams or kill your ideas or whatever you want to call it. Because odds are your first design is not going to work. You might get lucky. Some people do. But the first time you sit down and a prototype and take it to have people play it, it's probably going to be broken. And then the second part of that is start small, because it's probably going to be broken in the first place anyway. Mm. Don't make your first prototype something that takes you 3 days to put together just to have it broken in 10 minutes.
Yeah, I can agree with that. Yeah, if you're taking 3 days to do your first prototype, that's probably a problem right there. But yeah, I think even if your design isn't small, you can probably focus on some smaller part of that and test that.
Oh yeah,
absolutely.
If you got a larger game, it's going to have several mechanisms in it. Figure out which one is the core, test that one first, and then start adding in the other pieces as the base pieces start to function right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's generally a kind of a good practice. It's tough to have the multiple systems and figure out what the interactions for them are. And yeah, I think that takes a lot of skill that a new designer may not have. Do you guys want to throw out anything else about kind of your experience with designing games at this point before we swing over to our main topic?
I will say that it's very important to figure out which kind of design works for you in terms of how you get your start. whether you find a mechanism that you love and then apply a theme to it, or whether you come up with theme and apply the mechanism to it. Or if you're lucky, you'll get the idea that blends both of them together right from the start. But I would say 90% of mine are, I want to make a game about this. Now, what mechanism fits that idea? Which can be frustrating when those ideas, the ideas don't come in the first place. Then you're like, well, I've got this mechanism and this mechanism. You could make them trading in the Mediterranean. But then it's, you know, it's just kind of a waiting period, which can be frustrating as a designer.
Yeah, I think that at least starting off, you do tend to have an idea for a mechanism, or you have an idea for a theme, and you try to find the match for it. Later on, sometimes you'll kind of get them in concurrent thoughts, which is, I don't think, quite as common, but it can happen. You know, where you start doesn't matter. It's just trying to find a good match for mechanisms and theme, and to have it really harmonize. That's when you know you've got something that is definitely worth working on.
So I would want to give another piece of advice.
Only one allowed, sorry.
I'm going to give another one. It's too bad. Here it comes. And there's two parts to it. And the first part is play as many games as possible with as many different people as possible, just to get an idea of just how big the world of game design is and how many different places you can take things. And then the second thing is, when you are designing a game, scale that back, I would say. So don't play the games that are like the game you're designing. Or maybe try not to think about the other games that you've played. Because one thing that I've seen a lot of, and I've done this before, especially with a lot of the earlier stuff I was working on, designers basically building into their games assumptions from other games. So this is really common when you see designers building things that look like trading card games. The most common one that I've seen is the stack from Magic the Gathering, where a game designer that's been playing Magic a lot and wants to design a game that's got, you know, fantasy battle mechanics will just assume that the stack is something that is intuitive and that just exists in games.
And this is the way it has to be done. Like, I must have this in the game.
Oh, not necessarily that they're thinking of it as like a dogma like that, but they just, it's an underlying assumption. And so then when other people play the game and they're like, oh, what happens if I play this card at the same time as this other card? The person looks at them like, what, at the same time? What do you mean at the same time? You can't do that. Like, well, I can play this during the other person's turn. What if I play it? And players don't generally assume that. So there's this whole underlying framework of rules from a previous game that is sitting there and being, I don't know, being just assumed to exist. You see a lot of the same kind of thing when people that haven't played a lot of modern board games come in and they design like a roll and move game. It's just because, it's not because they think that all board games have to be roll and move, they're just assuming that that's a rule. Like, you have a guy on a board, how are you going to move him to the next space? Oh, a dice, because that's a thing.
Well, like, it's also like, if you take a mechanism that every game does the same thing. My big thing that I'm thinking about is deck building.
Yeah.
When you get a card in a deck builder, you always put it in the discard pile, at least as far as I'm aware of.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you design something without that mechanism, remember that you're going to have to break your playtesters and eventually the people who buy that game of that thought.
That's like the inverse side of it, right? So you're a designer, you've designed something that has some surface similarities to other games in that genre, but all of your players have this fixated idea in their head of how the rules are going to work. It's especially bad if someone tries to teach them the game and they're like, oh, this game is like Dominion, but this way. They're going to just assume a whole bunch of pieces of the game work a certain way, and then when they don't, they're like confused. But yeah, no, that's pretty similar.
I think that's a leap that, you know, designers have to make, and it's difficult to know that you have to make that. And it's almost like an aha moment when you do, when you're like, oh, it doesn't have to be like this. You know, I'm making all these assumptions that aren't necessarily true. And I think the sooner you can make that leap, the better designer you become. So we got to know Drew and James a little bit more. So let's get into our main topic here, which is designing dexterity games. We wanted to talk about this because a whole bunch of people in the group have designed some dexterity games for the Dice Hate Me Dexterity Game Challenge, which ended August 31st. And we had a lot of fun designing dexterity games. We learned a lot and thought this would be not necessarily a timely podcast since the contest is over, but we thought it would be a good time to talk about it since it's kind of fresh in our minds. So the first thing I want to make sure when we're talking about dexterity games is that we're all talking about the same thing. let's try to define a dexterity game first. So, Drew, what would your definition of a dexterity game be?
So this might be a little broad, but in general, I think it'd be fair to classify as a dexterity game any game that uses continuous space as part of its gameplay. Even a game like Daniel Solis's Kigi actually might be included under that, because you have to be able to place the card in such a way to satisfy certain requirements, and it requires a deal of manual dexterity in order to place it in the appropriate position. Was sitting around trying to think of any games that use continuous space that I wouldn't classify as that. And there were only a couple, and even then I think they're pretty edge case, because somebody that does it, like, if you don't have the manual dexterity to actually put the component in the right position, then you aren't going to be able to play the game properly. So
I'm definitely going to be slightly more constrained in my description. Basically, there's going to be an importance on either a component of the game moving or a component of the game not moving. And obviously it's going to depend on what game, whether they need to move a specific way or not move a specific way. Almost every dexterity game, I think, is going to have a component either required to move or not move for a player to advance or fail.
Yeah, I guess mine is not as broad as Drew's, maybe a little bit more broad than James, I'm not sure. But I would say that a dexterity game has an element of precision manual control, you know, a dexterous control or hand-eye coordination or things like that. And the precision is the key point there. You know, if you're playing like a stacking game or a flicking game or things like that, you're trying to be as precise as you can be. Off the top of my head, I can't think of a dexterity game where precision really doesn't matter. There might be one out there, but generally, yeah, you need to, you know, if you're trying to flick that disc into the other disc, well, that's precision. I know Drew is going to pull out some example to prove me wrong here.
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking about it. Yeah. I don't know if I'd be able to get one unless I want to extend our definition to, like, some sports. So I feel like there's a couple places where there would just be force rather than precision. But
so now the distinction between a dexterity game and a sport, that would be interesting, but I think that's probably beyond our scope here.
Definitely. I was thinking, like, some of the smaller, like, long games are close to, they're on a weird edge between board games and sports. So
yeah, wherever the continuum is, they're definitely splitting the two. I think that's true.
So here's an example to think about. In Space Cadets, I forget which one of the mini games, but you have to reach in and pull out pieces based on feel. Now, I would argue that that's dexterity, but you don't necessarily need precision. You're just trying to figure out if something is the correct shape or not based on touching it. Would you guys argue that's dexterity or not dexterity?
So I haven't played Space Cadets, but
Master Fox. I
haven't played Master Fox either, but I have played Dr. Shark, where you do pull
Dr.
out
Shark.
You know, you're trying to pull out puzzle pieces that have a texture that, you know, or match what you're looking for. I would argue that's a type of pattern recognition. Instead of visual, it's just tactile. I wouldn't say that's necessarily a dexterity game, although again, this could be a kind of a blurred line situation.
Definitely. And a lot of those games, you do have to root around in the bag or container for the object that you're trying to find. And so being able to, without looking, isolate a piece among a collection of pieces is something that takes a little bit of precision. So I do think that that would be the case. And since the position of those things in the bag is a continuous space, my definition still works. Boom.
Yeah. No. Yeah, it's definitely, like, I can see the argument. It's at the very least, it's straddling the line. Probably for this discussion, it's probably not something that would enter in too much, because I don't think any of us have designed anything that is,
no.
You know, we're trying to have that type of mechanism. But, you know, we have some bag builders, like Drew, your Art Thief game, but yeah. that's just cubes, you know. So that's
you're not trying to find a specific thing.
Unless you have a cube that
you can't,
right? Unless one of the cubes, you know, is slightly has a different feel. And you're like, oh yes, I can, you know, feel the little wood grain on that one. And then if you can do that. Holy hell, that's pretty good.
Figure out where the sprues are on the plastic.
Right. Yeah.
Gross.
Yeah. So, okay, so I think we have kind of a baseline definition for a dexterity game. So there's some amount of precision. You're going to have continuous space. I think that's a really good aspect. And that, you know, that'll include things from, like, animal upon animal to Daniel Solis's Ten Pen to, lots of games like that. So when designing dexterity game and other tabletop games, what are some of the major differences that you are considering for that design? So, James, we'll start with you on this one.
My biggest thing when I was designing a dexterity game is component, because a lot of these are going to be your pieces are going to be moving during the game, and they're going to be moving in a way that has significance. And if you play test with a different component, then all of a sudden when you get the actual component, it's going to require even more playtesting because suddenly all those interactions have changed. When I was designing my game, I started out with very small cubes, and it didn't work. And then we changed the size of the cubes, and suddenly it made sense because of the amount of space that the cubes took up on the board and the way they bounced off each other and that kind of thing.
So let's back up for a second. So, James, you're referring to Valley of the Mammoths. Go ahead and explain that for our listeners so they have some context here.
All right. So the idea is that you are a leader of a Neolithic tribe, and you're trying to hunt mammoths. And you have a bunch of cubes that represent your tribe members, and you're flicking them onto the board. And where they end up on the board is going to determine how you get to change your deck of cards. That's going to affect how much food you get, how much weaponry you have, and how many people you've actually sent out to hunt the mammoths that are in the title of the game. And so the action of flicking those cubes is really the heart of the game. And until I got the right pieces for that, the game just did not work because the board, like when you flick the cubes out onto the board, it just did not feel right at all.
And so, Drew, talk about your game. I can't remember what title you landed.
The title I ended up settling on for it was Oolong, because I gave it a theme that I thought was pretty cool, where you are growing a tea tree, and you have to send your meeples to pick the newest leaves off of the tea tree to get the most flavorful tea. The way that the game is set up is you have two cups that form a tree trunk, and then a series of cards that are the limbs and leaves of the tree. You're going to stack the cups on top of each other with cards sticking out in between to provide little places that you can anchor new cards. And on your turn, you're going to draw a card off the top of the deck and insert it somewhere on this tree. And based on the symbols on that card, you may or may not have to place a meeple balanced on that card, which is going to cause different things to happen, different weight distribution on the structure, might knock some stuff off. And any cards you knock off are added to your hand, and whoever has 10 cards in their hand at the end of the game. So that's the end of the game condition. That person loses, and whoever has the fewest cards wins. So one of the major differences in design, I guess, when designing a game like that versus designing sort of different kind of tabletop game, there's sort of two big ones. The first is that since the game is likely to work with continuous space, that needs to be taken into consideration when you're developing the rules. So, for example, one of the rules of my game when I started building it was the shaded part of a card, when you placed it into the tree, had to be completely invisible. Actually, the way that I worded it at first was the shaded part of the card has to be underneath another card, but then you run into a bunch of situations where someone's like, well, what if I crouch down at the edge of the table and like turn my head to the side and look up underneath here? I can still see the shaded part of that card, so you got to move it back in. Different things like that. Or when cards fall off the tree, whoever's turn it is, that person has to take them. So when does their turn begin and end? Because since we're dealing with continuous space, we're also kind of dealing with continuous time, right? So if I end my turn and we just wait for something to fall off the structure, and it does, whose turn is it? And who gets the card? So you have to be able to answer a lot of interesting questions like that that you wouldn't have to answer in a game with, you know, discrete space between turns, discrete space between actions, and, you know, discrete spaces for all the pieces. The second big one that I think...
Let me pause you for a second there. Yeah. So you mentioned continuous time. And I think that's a really, really good point to make, that in a dexterity game and also a real-time game, when you designing the game and you're designing the rule set, to be cognizant of that time does not essentially stop. And you do have to adjust your rules to compensate for that. And I think that's a really, really good point. I wanted to make sure we call that out.
There's a rabbit hole there about whether or not real-time games are dexterity games, but anyway, the second big thing I wanted to talk about is the amount that you have to consider different player types, I think, is actually really amplified in dexterity games. Most notably, that you have to have a way to deal with somebody that is playing the game very forcefully. Colloquially, I referred to this person as Dugan after a friend of mine, a Facebook acquaintance, who posted a bunch of pictures of them flexing all the time. So this person was Dugan, and so that's the person I imagine playing, you know, Talk Talk Woodman and just knocking everything over constantly, or playing Via Appia. So Via Appia is, I guess, not like a super popular game, so it's a game that effectively uses that sort of quarter pusher mechanic where you're shoving these round discs towards the edge of a ledge and you want them to fall off, but not have so many available for the next person. to knock them off. If you just, like, jam your arm at the board, you'll knock a bunch of things off. And there's nothing in the rules that says that you can't do that. but there should be. So
you're such a rules lawyer.
No, there really needs to be, because otherwise you can, you know, knock the table and get a whole bunch of resources. And according to everything in the rulebook, that's completely legitimate, which is actually a problem. So, I mean, it's not fun if someone's doing that, but you just don't want to have your players able to get themselves into a situation where that's what's happening in the game. I think it's another really important thing to consider.
So, you're right. That's going to lead into our next question here. So you're saying you have to, when designing the game, consider someone who is not necessarily playing poorly, but is playing strongly or roughly.
Yeah.
Is that the same thing as someone who is bad at dexterity games?
In a lot of cases, I think it is. In that specific one, it's not, because you're trying to knock stuff off of something. Mm-hmm. But like James said, most of the time you want to keep things from being knocked off. Another good example would be, actually, James's game, or something like Cube Quest, where someone could just, like, destroy the cube across the table. There needs to be something that deals with, like, what happens when someone's doing that.
Yeah, it was interesting, because I actually had to come up with rules, because you're flicking cubes onto a board from one side, and you're trying to hit the center. So I had to come up with what happens if you flick it off the board, what happens if you flick it all the way off the table, is that worse than just flicking it off the board? And of course, that then you have to think about how big someone's table is. And then also what happens when someone plays their piece so forcefully that it knocks someone else's off the board, what happens to that piece?
So what did you end up coming up with for those situations? So if someone knocks their piece off the board, what happens?
So if someone flicks their own piece off the board, generally it's wasted for that turn. And that's actually, it's easier to do that, ironically, at the beginning of your turn when the board is empty. You can just have your piece fly all the way across and fall off. By the end of the round, it's actually easier to knock someone else's off than to have your own go all the way off. I had at one point said, if you flick your piece all the way off the table, then it's gone for good, it's out of the game. But certain people found that too restrictive, and so it happened so infrequently that I left that out, and it's treated the same way as you just knock it off the board. If someone flicks their cube and knocks someone else's off the board, then that person will get theirs back to flick at the end of the round, which is actually a bonus for them. So if somebody else is playing so forcefully that they push someone else off the board, the person they push off the board gets basically a bonus at the end of the round when everybody else is already in place to put theirs out in a less dangerous spot.
So those were things that you all discovered during playtesting?
Yeah, I don't know if it was discovered during playtesting. I guess probably in the early playtesting, somebody who was really bad at flicking just flicked off the board and said, "What now?" And so then I had to come up with that right away. The one where somebody else flicks theirs into yours and knocks you off the board, that one actually seemed fairly obvious. It's like, well, it wasn't your fault that it left the board, and there's no, like, it's not a combat game, so you can't physically hurt the other player by knocking them off the board. So it's like, well, they pushed you out of the way, even though you were standing there, you get to go somewhere else, essentially.
So you initially had a rule where if it went off the table, it was gone for good, and that turned out to be too irritating for some players. So with that, did you rein that back essentially based on playtester feedback, or was it also, it was just something where you weren't comfortable with it, or, you know, what was the decision point where you decided to remove that?
Well, it was playtester feedback. Some people said, you know, I feel bad about this. Especially if you have somebody and you know they're bad at flicking, and the other person on the other side of the board moves all their cubes over to the side and kind of clears a pathway off the table. That's no fun to have happen to you. But then as people got more experience at it, it also happened extremely infrequently. So it was one of those extreme edge cases where it could have just as easily been the same as just knocking it off the board. And it's still going to be a penalty. And so it's like, do I want to have that extra situation for something that happens in one out of every 50 games when you could just have it be something less penalizing and not really have it change?
So it sounds like both of you in your rule sets for your dexterity games, you did have considerations for, you know, quote unquote, a bad player or someone who is bad at dexterity. Is that accurate?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's not actually so much different from any other game where you want to have some consideration for a player that's not doing very well. You want them to be able to play, but you probably don't want them to win, right? So you have to essentially give them some sort of way to release pressure off of the losing player in a way that's not likely to be, unless you really want that to be the, you know, center of the game, power grid style, I guess, in some way that's not likely to let them kind of catapult back into the lead.
That was actually a major development within Mammoth, because if you're bad at flicking, then you're just not going to get any upgrades to your cards, and come the end of the game, you will basically have no ability to do anything while everybody else is out hunting. And so I believe it was actually you, Matt, that we had the basically you get one extra cube at the end of the game, and you can just put it somewhere as your chief. You get to make that choice. And so introducing that choice at the end to offset the randomness or the seeming randomness of the other four cubes gives you that little bit of certainty in what is an otherwise extremely uncertain outcome.
I'll take credit for that. Yeah.
The way I'm taking care of it in Oolong is essentially when you knock cards off of the tree, you add those cards to your hand. So players that are further behind have more options for which card they're going to play on their turn, and so they're more likely to be able to place something that's relatively easy. Additionally, there's a sort of challenge or daring mechanic where if a player thinks that none of the cards in their hand are particularly easy to place, they can sort of challenge the other players to do it at the cost of potentially gaining a couple more cards. But it makes it so that there's options. There's actually more options for players that are falling behind, and so there's always something that that player can do with the hand of cards that they've got, even if they don't feel like they'll be able to place any of them at the moment.
So is it accurate to say that both of you feel that every dexterity game should have considerations for a poor player?
I think every game should have considerations for a poor player, but that's a different topic.
Yeah.
And honestly, certain games within the dexterity space are so either fast or light, or perhaps both, that honestly, it's like some games, if you're not good at dexterity, then it is okay just to sit out. And I hate to say that as a designer. It's like, oh, I don't want you to play if you're bad. But some games are so light like that. Like, you know, certain, like Tok Tok Woodman takes 5 minutes. And
5 minutes? Man, I've been in some epic games of TikTok Woodman where people are just tapping and they're like, oh, nothing fell off. Anyway.
Yeah. So if you're, there's really no mechanism in there if you're bad at using the axe. There's no other than staying at zero and hoping no one else, or so everyone else goes negative.
Right? Like, hope everyone else goes negative. Yeah. I don't know. So I think that consideration needs to be made, but I think it's basically the same consideration I would usually want to make, which is the player can still do things. And Tok Tok Woodman, actually, like, it's a pretty fun game, and it's pretty short, so you don't hear a lot of complaints about it, but actually that's kind of a problem, I think. The player that's not very good at using the axe just has to either, you know, sit out because I can't play this game, or hope everyone else goes negative. So it'd be cool if there was something for them to be able to do apart from just tap the tree and hope.
But yeah, as you go up in play length and in
weight,
you definitely need to start introducing those situations where someone who's not good at dexterity can still compete in some other facet of the game.
So that's a good segue for our next question then. So for players who really like dexterity games, is there, would you say, a limit to the amount of complexity that a dexterity game can have and still be a satisfying game? Or do you think there's no appreciable limit?
So you quantified that at the beginning, right? You said four players that really like dexterity games?
Yes, because, I mean, people who like stock-holding games, sure, like, they'll be more predisposed to enjoy 18xx games, whereas someone who does not like stock-holding games probably would not like an 18xx game, and therefore that kind of complexity may not be applicable to that player. But a player who does like dexterity, or does like, you know, a certain mechanism, my guess is that they would probably allow more complexity than a player who does not like that mechanism. That may be an incorrect assumption, but I think that kind of where this question is coming from.
Yeah, yeah. I think you're right about that. And so if we're going with players that are not predisposed to dislike dexterity mechanics, I don't think there's really any good reason that there would be an upper limit. Dexterity is just another mechanism. It's another way of kind of adding some uncertainty into something. You know, you could have dice, or you could have throw this thing onto this target, except for throw this thing onto this target actually has some, a little bit more element of, I guess depending on the what kind of loaded dice you're using, has some element of control over it. Not perfect, but some. So I don't see it as really different than any other element of uncertainty in a game that's got really high complexity. I think the issue is that as you increase in complexity, the Venn diagram of people that'll play that game and people that are okay with dexterity starts to become an 8. So,
sure. I mean, that would most likely be true of every mechanism. And as you ramp up in complexity, eventually you're gonna narrow down your audience.
Except for stock holding.
maybe. I don't know. Is there something above 18xx? I don't know.
It's interesting. A lot of times it feels like in dexterity games, rather than ramping up in complexity, a lot of times you'll have the game ramp up in length or breadth or something like that. You know, you have the basic pitch card tracks versus the extremely long pitch card tracks. Even though you're doing the same thing, you have to do it more carefully, or you have to do it more accurately, but it's still the same action. And then you have the seriousness of the players.
That's
you
true.
Have, and I'm guilty of this myself, I take certain dexterity games way too seriously.
What's an example of that?
I have a stacking game called Bandu, and so everybody else is just kind of lightly placing pieces, and I will get down on my knees and ever so slightly place it in just the right place because I want to succeed at that game. And so everybody else is playing for fun, and I'm playing to prove a point almost.
Ow.
And so it kind of splits the group playing the game into two parts.
It's and about usually sending a message.
Usually I'm alone in that second part.
Yeah, I think I've only played Bandu once with you, and it's like, huh, he's taking this pretty seriously. This is a shape stacking dexterity game. If there were cat pictures on here, it would be the same game, you know. But you wouldn't. It might be better. Yeah, I don't know, but
not definitively. Objectively, it would be better. Real quick, what's the most complex dexterity game, like rules complex, you've actually encountered?
I haven't played it, but my understanding is that Catacombs is fairly complex in terms of just the sheer number of pieces and the variety of rules those pieces have for combat and the setup and everything like that.
I also haven't played it, but I think Ascending Empires probably has some complexity to it, and Dungeon Twister.
Dungeon Fighter.
I'm sorry, Dungeon Fighter. Yeah, Dungeon Twister is the card game. Yeah, Dungeon Fighter.
Yes.
That one, I think the difficulty of that dexterity element makes that, maybe complex isn't the right word, maybe just difficult is the right word.
So Dungeon Fighter is actually the one that I was thinking of, and also Via Appia, I think, has a Euro game around it. It's not like a really complicated Euro game, but you know, it's more than you expect to sort of see when someone just, I guess, higher than the average for a dexterity game. And with both of those, it's been pretty hard to get people to play them. Not they're excited to play them until they find out about the dexterity component. So Via Appia, they're like, oh, it's a Euro game. I play at Gamers Armory. There's a lot of people that play about that weight of Euro game there. So I'm like, yeah, let's play this. And then you set up the little quarter pusher thing, and people are like, well, you know, I could do something else. Or a Dungeon Fighter, which has a lot of the rules elements of a pretty typical dungeon crawl game. You're a party and you fight monsters that have HP and magic attacks and different spells and things, but you're doing all of it by bouncing dice onto a target, which is really, like you said, it's pretty miserably difficult. But both of those have been harder to get people to play, I think, because of what I said earlier. Like, the people that will tolerate the dexterity element maybe don't want that length of game as often, but the few examples that have done it, like we all just mentioned, are pretty highly regarded among people that will deal with those things. So
it's true. Yeah, I mean, Ascending Empires has
it's a Grail game now, right?
It's totally a Grail game. Yeah, and I believe it still has a pretty decent rating on Board Game Geek. And Catacombs was a Grail game for a little while, and then they had the Kickstarter to reprint it with new artwork, which was divisive for some reason. I'm not sure why.
That's super great. So
yeah, everything great is divisive. Yes, and that one is out now, and I believe that one also is still very highly regarded. So yeah, it's clearly there's going to be some upper limit of complexity, just because, you know, you can't have infinite complexity. But it does seem like for the people that like dexterity elements, that you can layer in a lot of complexity, and they're still going to be, you know, find something interesting in the game.
I think dexterity elements add some sort of air of not seriousness to games. Like, for example, James said he takes Baidu seriously, and that's apparently strange, which I think it is. Like, I wouldn't expect it, but I don't understand why I would expect someone to take Baidu not seriously and then to take, I don't know, Ticket to Ride any more seriously. But I think I would. Like, if someone's just doing goofy stuff in Ticket to Ride, I'd be like, why are you playing? Come on. Like, that's not a good thing to do. And then someone, like, places something really super easily on the Baidu board, then you're like, oh, you know, you could have placed that in a lot more treacherous position, but you didn't. Is it because you're not taking this seriously? And then people are like, well, it's Baidu. So, I don't know. So I think there's an air of, like, toyishness or not seriousness about it that causes that sort of pushback.
And a lot of times with that, with the balancing games, you have the other game, well, most other games, everybody plays and somebody comes in first. With a lot of the stacking games, it's one person fails and everybody else wins. And so you have, I mean, Baidu is the one where it's like, well, you can't have a winner because of the way that the trading goes on and everybody's building their own space. But usually with those kind of things, somebody fails and everybody else wins. And so if you fail, then it's not just that you caused someone to win, it's that you caused everyone else to win. And everyone else is generally going to be okay with winning.
That's a good point. That almost puts it closer to like a party game type of feel, where like a lot of party games, it's you might have a winner, but no one cares. Or it's one person is the loser and everyone else wins, you know, that kind of thing. And you're right, I hadn't really thought about it. There are a lot of dexterity games, or at least stacking dexterity games, where it's just one person causes it to fall down. Like Jenga is the classic example, and everyone else is the winner. And so that's definitely, since I personally am not going to win by myself, you know, maybe that is the license to take it not quite as seriously as you would a game like Ticket to Ride, where there will be one winner. And so therefore, I do want to compete and attempt to win, so I do take it a little bit more seriously. Yeah, that's a really interesting point. When you guys were designing your dexterity games, did you find that there were any specific dexterity skills that people seemed to like more? So we'll start with you, James. I don't know if you always had flicking or if you had some other things. Or
it was generally always flicking. People love to hit a target, especially when other people are trying to hit the same target. Most of the exclamations that you'll hear when people play the game is when someone's got a cube out there and they have it on the action space that they want to take, and someone else flicks their cube and knocks it off, and suddenly you've got people screaming at each other, I needed that action! And now they've got to put another cube in that same space, but their neighbor is already sitting in that space, and so they're going to get bumped, and it just cascades in, and people are just, people find a lot of joy in that, I think, or joy and frustration as they put it in the word that needs, and then someone else knocks it away and they have to knock them away, and back and forth.
So how about you as a player? Do you have a particular dexterity skill that you prefer? I mean, we've been talking about balancing, but I'm not sure if that's your favorite.
It probably is, but most of the balancing games are smaller, and so I've had a chance to play more of them versus the flicking games. A lot of them tend to take up lots of space, and so they don't get out much. Things like Pitch Car and Crokinole and things like that, they're either more expensive because you need a bigger surface, or they're just straight up bigger because you need to be able to lay out a larger Pitch Car board. That's why you see it mostly. Most of the time I see it coming out is at conventions and things like that, where people will bring a suitcase of nothing but Pitch Car, and so you don't really bring that to a board game meetup, you know, on a weeknight for a couple of hours.
That's heavy.
Because you're going to devote an entire play session to just that game.
Yeah, it's a lot to set up too, so the setup would be a factor in that as well. You know, if it takes you a half hour to set up for a 4-hour meetup, that's probably not a good time. How about you, Drew? Have you noticed any particular dexterity skill that people seem to favor over others?
I don't know if this is a skill as much as a type of interaction, but I've noticed that in dexterity games, people have a very sort of vested interest in being able to set up someone else for failure. So a lot of games, a lot of the dexterity games, the balancing ones are this way. Even some of the flicking games, things like Crokinole, have some ability for you to put a piece in such an awful place that the next person's turn becomes tremendously more difficult. Yeah, so animal upon animal, I put, you know, some awful penguin on its back sitting in some terrible place that there's no way any other piece could touch it or it'll fall off. Jenga is just all about that. You're trying to remove what's the worst possible piece that I can remove successfully so that the next person's going to have a real bad time.
It becomes, I'm not going to win, but you're going to fail. And because we get back to that earlier issue of when one person fails, everybody else wins, well, therefore making you fail makes me win.
Right, yeah. And since a lot of them have that sort of victory structure, it makes a lot more sense. But it definitely seems like something that players really enjoy. So in Oolong, I've noticed that once someone gets sort of comfortable with what they're doing, people will tend to try to place cards so that they're just barely hanging onto the tree, to the point where when someone's drawing a card off the top, the whole structure kind of bounces and things are threatening to fall off just by touching the structure at all. And so that's the thing that people seem to really, really get into and feels really good when they're able to successfully pull it off.
Now that you said that aloud, I noticed that a lot, especially stacking games. Yeah, I think in stacking or balancing games, it's probably a little bit easier to set up the next player, not necessarily for failure, but just to make their turn as hard as you can. I think with flicking, at least the flicking games that I've played, I think it's a little bit more difficult, but it's still possible.
Yeah, especially if you are making them take their next shot from some kind of awful place.
Right.
Or you're able to put your piece in between them and their objective so that they're less likely to be able to get it.
Like caveman curling, right? So you get your piece in front of them and you know, if they want to try to get close to the target, they're probably going to knock you closer to the target. Yeah, that's true. So how about, Drew, you as a player, is there a particular dexterity mechanism that you prefer?
I like to knock people's pieces away from anything. So Sorry Sliders is probably one of the dexterity games that I've played the most. There's an awful pit in the middle. Knocking people into that is fun. Crokinole has that same kind of mechanic, I think. Hole in the middle you can knock people into, and some of the boards, I think. I'm not sure if all the boards are the same. Or Karam or whatever, the disc flicking on the surface game.
So flicking and throwing, that's kind of what you prefer?
Like hitting target less than a stationary sort of goal where you're trying to get something into there. Being able to like hit somebody's piece in sort of a direct player interaction kind of combative way is something I'm really into.
When you have an idea for a game and you want to have dexterity either in the game or the game essentially is a dexterity mechanism, how do you determine what type of dexterity mechanism to put into the game? Do you start with the mechanism and you build a game around there, or do you have kind of the game idea and then you search for a specific dexterity mechanism to add? So Drew, we'll start with you.
Well, in this case, the sort of birth of this design was I saw the Animal Upon Animal card game, the local game store, and I didn't know anything about that, and I'd never heard anything about it existing, so I kind of imagined what I thought that it would be like. And then I looked it up on BoardGameGeek, and it's nothing like that. So I decided to try to see if the thing that I thought would work would actually work. And just so it started completely with the mechanism, which was stacking cards in some sort of haphazard way out from a surface. It was all about figuring out what kind of cool thing I could do with these components that had that sort of construction. So you're building a larger and larger structure that people are adding things to. So I don't know, that's how I decided it. And then the rest of the theme came from the actual visual look of the game once you were building the structure. It looked a lot more like a tree than anything else. So searched for a bunch of different types of themes that had to do with tree climbing or growing or something like that. I don't know, that's how I decided what I was going to do with that game. And I think that any of the other sort of dexterity game ideas have always sort of come from figuring out what to do with some really odd component.
How about you, James? Did you start with the dexterity mechanism and build a game around it, or did you have your game idea and then you search for a dexterity mechanism to add in?
Well, Mammoth definitely started out as a blend. I was very fortunate in that the theme and the mechanics kind of blurred together as a coherent package when I started out, but I initially started not necessarily with the component, or not necessarily with the mechanism, but I saw in my mind what I wanted people to be doing with the game. Since the game is called Vow of the Mammoth, I initially thought, what if I set up basically cliffs and have people launching pieces off of this cliff into a valley to do stuff? And so that was the core idea of the game, starting with the components, not even necessarily the mechanism. I knew they've got to get into the valley somehow, so the only way is to literally push them off the cliff, and then all the other pieces fell in after that.
So your mechanism is flicking, but you could have chosen like throwing, or you could have chosen some type of balance where you got to balance it in a way where it's going to fall off. You know, did you just jump to flicking right away, or did you try a couple of different dexterity mechanisms to see which one would work best?
I do think I started with flicking, although like I said earlier, I started with a very different size and weight component and was fortunate that I found a different component that worked much better before I gave up on the flicking. I mean, it just seems like the flicking versus trying to throw something Which, I mean, it's really the same, too. You're aiming a piece for a target. Whether you're flicking it off a surface or throwing it from your hand, you're still trying to get your piece to a target through the force of your hand. And so it really did start out that way, and then everything else developed. So, yeah, I guess it did start out as a flicking mechanism.
I think it's really important, actually, that you chose flicking instead of throwing or something else like that. Because just from a rules standpoint with that smaller scale interaction of flicking, it's easier to define like where somebody is starting from and where they're supposed to end up. Games that have like throwing stuff at the table always have this strange little, I mean, I'm being the rules lawyer again, but it is an issue.
Oh, very much.
Where it's like, oh, you stand, you know, some vague distance away from the table and don't do this thing where you stretch your arm way out because that's bad. And
you have to throw it from above the table but not above the board and so on and so forth.
All these things, right? And so with flicking, you're able to just like put it on this spot. Okay, now that's it. There you go.
Yeah, and I mean, with Valley of the Mammoths, I initially had little like foam core launch pads that you had. Yeah. You literally had to flick off of your launch pad into the center. You know, that was eventually cut for component reasons because nobody wants to package four large launch pads in the game. But the idea at least stuck.
In your experience, what was the most difficult part of designing a dexterity game? So, James, we'll start with you.
The most difficult part of designing it, at least. So I know the most difficult part overall was the rules, but, I mean, really figuring out, because when you're in a flicking game, you're going to be having your spaces occupy physical space. And like Srua said, it's a continuous space. It's not a discrete space. So the size and the number of components are really tricky because you've got to figure out how many actions do people get, how long does it take somebody to flick. You can have people that flick really fast, and you can have people that will sit and think for 20 seconds or, you know, maybe they want to do over. You know, there's all sorts of issues that can change the game based on how you've got those components. And so really making sure you have the right components for a dexterity game can make or break your design, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that. We'll come back to components in a moment. But Drew, same question for you. What was the most difficult part for you?
Actually, we're going to go to components right now because the most difficult part for me was creating a prototype that would accurately reflect what the finished product's gameplay would be like. And so since I was making a card game, making sure that I replicated, you know, and we're balancing things on top of cards that are sticking out of a structure. The weight of the cards is really important. Can't just use my typical magic sleeve with a slip of paper on top of it, which I actually did for the first prototype, but the cards are a lot heavier and the sleeve is a lot more slick, so it makes it really substantially different how the structure will expand and grow. Then I tried blank cards with stickers on them, but the stickers, the way that you're wedging cards in between other cards, having the different raised surface on there caused a bunch of problems. So ended up using those blank playing cards, and then once I had those, figuring out how the other components of the game, the different the cups that are being used for the tree trunk and the wooden pieces that are being balanced on top of the cards, whether or not those resemble the final components and how much difference it makes. So, like, the first cup that I used had a little lip on the bottom of it, and I was sitting it upside down, and that made it really easy to tuck cards in there. When I got my second prototype, I, by chance, brought a different cup to use, and it didn't have that lip, and it made it a lot harder. Getting something that was as close to final was kind of tough, so.
Yeah, that was surprising for me. I'm not sure if it was surprising for you guys, but when I was working on my dexterity games, it just didn't occur to me when I started that, yeah, the components are really, really important. And just like James said earlier, the slight change in, you know, maybe a cube or like Drew, like you said, changing cards has a huge impact on the game. And yeah, I guess in hindsight, it's obvious, right? But at the time, getting started, that was very surprising for me. And you discover, oh, wow, yeah, so if I'm going to use, you know, 16-millimeter cubes that are weighing 2 grams, or I don't know what they actually weigh. is two grams a lot? I don't even know. You know, that has one feel when you're flicking those, but then all of a sudden now we're using 20 millimeter and they're a lot lighter because they're hollow. They're not solid. And you know, all of a sudden now I can flick them, you know, into the wall across the room. So you can say, okay, those aren't going to work. And yeah, that was kind of a real aha moment when I was working on my designs that, yeah, need to focus on the components and try to nail those down in parallel to actually nailing down the actual game design. So, you have an idea for a dexterity game. What are your recommendations for making that initial prototype? So, Drew, we'll start with you.
So, all of the times that I've started designing a dexterity game, the initial prototype has just been, here are a bunch of pieces that I think it would be fun to play with. What are the different interactions that I can do with those pieces? So making the initial prototype hasn't really been an issue, because that's where the idea came from, was I had a, you know, some collection of objects, and that's the prototype. Figuring out, you know, how those are interacting is like sort of the prototype of the rule set. I've always, all of those ideas I've started from having some idea of what the component I wanted to use would look like. And so it's changed, you know, pretty significantly. Like for Oolong, I ended up using different cards and not sleeved cards, and a different cup for the tree trunk. And then the foam blocks game, I'm doing some interesting things with those. But yeah, I don't know. So making the initial prototype has been, for me, like going to, when I'm in some store or some place, seeing the interesting object that might be fun to play with, I guess buying that is making the initial prototype.
So, okay, that's really interesting. So, in a way, you're suggesting a third method of starting a design. So instead of starting with theme or starting with a mechanism, you're starting with components.
In the arena of a dexterity game, I actually think that choosing the components is in some way choosing the mechanism, right? Because their shape determines how they're able to interact with each other. And so that's kind of part of them. It's going to be part of the mechanism of the dexterity game, right? So,
yeah, I agree completely.
Oh, cool. Then that means it must be totally.
I say, my suggestion is, if you're going to start designing a dexterity game, go to Michael's or some other craft store and just walk down their aisle of little wood pieces and just look and see what they have. They've got discs and cubes and other weird shapes that might stack, and just think about how would these pieces interact with each other.
That's a really good point, and that's, I feel like that is very different from designing other types of games where, you know, the advice is, you know, start with theme, start with mechanisms, start with something. But usually, at least the advice that I've encountered, it's not start with components. So yeah, that it is a little bit of a kind of flip your design brain when you're talking about a dexterity game. This is going to lead into, you know, so you've got your prototype now. So how do you test a dexterity game? And are there any specific implications that a dexterity game will have for playtesting that maybe just a non-dexterity game wouldn't have?
The biggest difference, I think, when testing a dexterity game, or what you're going to look at when testing a dexterity game versus testing another type of game, is the time element of the design becomes a lot more important to think about. So how long does it take to set up versus how long does it take to play? How long does it take to reset if some part of the, you know, in Gulo Gulo, you fail the task, you pour all of the eggs or marbles back into a bag and reset that thing. It's pretty easy to do. If they were using a Jenga tower instead, it'd be insufferable.
Yep.
And so there's a lot of elements of time that you have to consider more than you would with some other game. In particular, like I was kind of talking about earlier, the continuous space between players' turns actually becomes something really important. So one of the things that I discovered early on was that I had to be very kind of rigid about when a player's turn begins and ends, because otherwise stuff would disappear through the cracks between players' turns and really cause a lot of really interesting questions about who has to now take that card. Yeah, there's a lot of more consideration about how much time different things take, I think.
I found it very interesting because in most hobby board games, when you succeed, you're going to have either intellectual or emotional satisfaction. Yes, mm-hmm. I made this system work and I succeeded at it. With a lot of dexterity games, you're going to have physical satisfaction. And so it's like, yes, I threw that where it needed to go, I balanced this and it's not moving anymore, or I flicked the piece and, you know, part of it is going to be the satisfaction of having the components do what you're trying to have them do. And so that is a big part of the prototyping process as well, is this action physically satisfying to the players?
So you would classify that differently from emotional satisfaction? Or is it more coupled with emotional satisfaction?
Well, I was about to say it's coupled with emotional, but it's definitely not. Like, if you got a system in a fairly complex Euro game, you're going to feel intellectually satisfied to say, yes, I figured out this system and I got it to do what I want to do. I got it to chug along. But that's very, very different from when you flick a cube and it lands on the spot that you wanted it to land on because you did the physically correct action.
Okay. Yeah, I guess it definitely is a different, I guess, section of your brain that seems to trigger, you know, and a different type of satisfaction. And what exact type that is, I don't know, would probably take a psychologist to analyze that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's an interesting point. There's definitely something about, you know, like if you have a card throwing game, you manage to throw the card and land at just the right place. And you're like, yes, I got, yeah, that's exactly what it had to happen. That was an awesome feeling. Maybe some, you know, endorphins get released a little bit. That usually doesn't happen quite as much if you're playing some type of game where you have maybe simultaneous role selection and where you're like, yes, I got to, you know, I guessed the right role and I was able to take advantage of someone else because they did not anticipate what I was going to do. So yeah, that's a really interesting kind of, you know, emotional, physical, some type of satisfaction that you don't quite get in other games. I think that's a good point. Is there any other advice you would give for testing a dexterity game that might be different from testing any other type of game?
Yeah, actually. So I think dexterity games tend to be, this isn't always true, but they tend to be a lot more focused on failure states than other games. So this might be because of the change to the victory structure that James was talking about earlier, where a lot of them have somebody triggers the end of the game by losing and everyone else wins, or the game ends when somebody fails. But because they're focused on that, there's a need to make sure that it doesn't feel so bad for the person that triggers it. But in a lot of designs, you'd want to avoid these kinds of epic failure states. And in a lot of dexterity games, you actually are almost certainly building towards one. So you have to manage it rather than avoid it. Like the kind of action that makes someone knock over the tower in Jenga is a lot like someone, you know, running out of money in an economic game. Like they've failed pretty catastrophically and changed the state of the game. But, you know, in one, you would want to give the player some way to get away from that. And the other one, you just want to make sure that when that happens, because that's what we're building towards, it's going to be okay for all the players. Like everyone's going to be all right with that outcome.
How about you, James? Any other advice for testing a dexterity game?
Aside from what we've already talked about, I don't know that I've got any more. Just focus on the components and focus on the satisfaction. Because if people don't find the actions that you're making them do to win the game, then they're not going to be interested in doing them repeatedly.
I would wager that there's probably more repeated actions in most dexterity games than there are in other types of games. When you're playing a card in a card game, I guess if you consider that all the same, but usually, you know, the cards are different, so it feels like a different action. But if you're in a dexterity game, you know, you're going to flick often, or you're going to balance a piece often. And so that, even though it might be a different piece, it feels like the same type of action. So yeah, you definitely want to make sure it's something that doesn't feel repetitive, and, you know, that it's still fun for the duration of the game. So when you guys were designing your dexterity games, was there anything that really kind of surprised you as you went through the process? So we'll start with you, James.
I was really surprised at the way that people reacted to it. Because, I mean, I like dexterity games, but it was amazing to see how that, especially you get the gut reaction from people that you don't get in a lot of other games. And it's like, it really is, I do feel like it's unique that dexterity games bring that out in people. You'll rarely get people standing up to play Ticket to Ride, but
it would have to be real cutthroat.
Yeah, but you will always get people standing up to play certain dexterity games, even if it's just as easy to do it sitting down, just because the level of excitement and the level of tension is raised within the game because of the physical failure or success.
How about you, Drew? Anything surprising about your experience?
You know, I actually don't think that the experience was really surprising. In any way, we haven't really mentioned already, surprisingly different from testing or designing any other kind of game. Apart from, I guess maybe I was surprised how ready people were to take the game seriously or to playtest it seriously, especially among non-game designers. So I had a lot of people, a bunch of different venues sort of playtesting this the mechanism here, and people that I wouldn't expect to be willing to, you know, devote 15 minutes of their time to playtesting Words on Cards with me were more than happy to come over and test this out. So that was pretty surprising. It was a lot easier to get non-game designers to playtest, and not only to playtest, but to also give pretty meaningful feedback as opposed to the sort of, yeah, it was cool thing that you yeah. might often get. Yeah. So,
is there anything that you can attribute that to?
I used a word earlier, the word toyishness, and I think that's actually a big part of it. So I think the same reason that a lot of serious board gamers might be less inclined to take a dexterity game seriously, people that wouldn't play more serious board games are more inclined to interact with something that's toyish. So, because they don't have to take it that seriously, and if there's competitiveness going on, there's like kind of a circle around the game that they can be like, oh, we're just playing with this thing and it's fine. So I think that that's definitely something that's attractive. And kind of the same thing with regards to the difficulty getting games like Via Appia and Dungeon Fighter to the table among quote-unquote board gamers. I've been a lot more successful getting those games to the table with people that would not play Ticket to Ride with me. Because they're like, oh, I want to play with that there's a quarter pusher thing. I want to touch it. I want to play with it. So I don't know. Just the difference in attitude there has been pretty surprising, I suppose.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't put any of my designs in front of, you know, outside of our game design group, so I hadn't experienced that myself. It's interesting. I wonder if part of that toyish aspect kind of gives the signal to people that generally don't play games that it's okay to play this, and it's okay that you might feel stupid because it's just a toy. Like, if they have that type of attitude coming into it, is I think that is, you know, that's a barrier for some people for playing games because they don't want to feel stupid. And so I don't know, like, playing with the toy, who cares, it's a toy,
right? Yeah, it doesn't look like a, you know, a serious contest where someone's likely to, and that's also the attitude that a lot of players have, right? This is a very serious contest, and because I'm better at Ticket to Ride, I keep saying Ticket to Ride, but that's not a great example here, because I'm better at, you know, Glory to Rome, this is a measurement of something.
we don't need to say what
that would be.
Yeah.
And you have the idea that everyone at some level understands the mechanism of dexterity.
Sure.
You understand flicking a piece down a path. You understand balancing a piece on another one. If you say, oh, you would draft these cards, well, somebody might not understand what that means, and you have to explain the whole process. But if you say, you have to flick this piece and have it hit that target, they're like, okay, I understand that.
That's a really good point. It is something that is either not much of a leap for, you know, anyone's knowledge, or no leap at all because they already know it. And, you know, they most likely flicked something at some point in their life when they were a kid or whatever. So yeah, it is something that is much easier to bridge any gap that they might have. All right. So to wrap this up, is there any advice that you would give a designer who wants to design a dexterity game that we haven't already talked about? So how about you first, Drew?
We kind of went over this earlier, but if you ever just pay attention to what people do with the pieces of games that you watch people play. Anytime that someone's got downtime during a game, they're going to be interacting with objects in some way that's kind of non-standard, I guess. People stack meeples and people do odd things with cards and balance things. And anytime you basically see someone doing that kind of interaction, that's a potential foundation for something. So you have to kind of pay attention to things like that, but there's ideas for like dexterity mechanisms everywhere, so you don't have to start with, you know, something that's already standard interaction for those things. You can come up with something else by just watching what people are doing naturally with the components that you've got.
Very good. How about you, James? Any other advice?
I think you got to make sure that when you're going into it, you realize that you're not working with the two pillars of theme and mechanics. You're working with three pillars: themes, mechanic, and components. And just like you would change your theme, just like you would change your mechanic, you're probably going to have to change your components. Probably more likely to change your components as you go through the game.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I think, you know, we all change components, even if it was just, you know, from a fake card to a real card, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would still, that's a change, and it's a surprisingly big change.
Absolutely.
All right, excellent. Well, that was a really good discussion about designing dexterity games. Hopefully that's going to be helpful for people. So now we're going to get into our Game Designers of North Carolina news segment. So the news we have for this episode is... Avalanche at Yeti Mountain is still funding on Kickstarter. That is my game that is being put out by Green Couch Games. As we're recording this, it's over 75% now with 2 weeks to go. Woo! Absolutely. So plenty of time to check out the project if it looks like something fun. I personally guarantee that it will be fun. Not a guarantee wherever you're listening. And the Jason Kotarski behind Green Couch Games, he just today announced, or I'm sorry, yeah, yesterday actually, announced that there's add-ons for a playmat. There's add-ons for Fidelitas, which is the first game that Green Couch Games put out. And there's an add-on for Best Treehouse Ever, which is the second game that they put out, and this is the first time it's available to get it since the Kickstarter campaign. So if you were looking for Best Treehouse ever, this would be a good way to grab that before, I believe, before it's even going to be available at retail. The project ends October 1st, so you have until then to check it out. The other piece of news is Eugene Shenderov has launched his campaign for Comrades and Patriots. That one we talked about last episode that was going to be launching, and that is now launched. It launched back on September 8th, and it's going to run until October 6th. You can go check that one out. It's actually two games in one. They are two games where you can combine them together to make a big game. You can keep them separate. The two games are Most Incorruptible Patriot and Most Glorious Comrade. One is kind of set in historical Russia. The other is kind of set in historical United States. $25 pledge level to get that. At the moment, it's about 25% funded. Hopefully that'll pick up soon. Links to Avalanche at Yeti Mountain and Comrades and Patriots will be in the show notes for this episode. All right. So, Drew, do you have any plugs you want to share?
Sure, yeah. So I'm on Twitter at Even Weirder Move, and that's my, well, sort of my BGG handle as well. Twitter wouldn't let me get all the characters, but BGG handle is an Even Weirder Move.
How about you, James? Any plugs?
I'm on BGG as Space Nut, and I'm on Twitter as Apollo Continuum. That's APOLLOCONTINUUM. And that's actually the name of the world that I've been world building for quite a while now.
I did not know that. Very cool. So if you've enjoyed this episode, please join our guild on BoardGameGeek. If you go to podcast.gdofnc.com, that's podcast.gdofnc.com, and that stands for Game Designers of North Carolina. That will redirect you to our guild on BGG. You can subscribe, join in on the conversation that we'll have about each episode. We also have a Twitter account you can follow, which is at GD of NC. And if you tweet at the account, someone running it will probably have a snarky response for you. You can also find our episodes through iTunes and through Stitcher. Please feel free to give us a review through either service. That would be awesome. You might be the first person if you do that. And that'll do it for this episode of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and remember to spay and neuter your meeples, and we'll see you next time.